thunder, 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 thunder. Oh!
What are you looking at, nerd? Huh?
Thunder nerds,
thunder nerds,
thunder nerds.
Get those nerds!
Welcome to Thunder Nerds. I'm Brian Hinton.
And I'm Frederick Philip Von Weiss, and thank you for consuming the Thunder Nerds, a conversation with the people behind the technology that love what they do.
And do tech good.
Ah, boom. Hey, and today we have a very special guest that already spoke at the Front End Design Conference. We have Jared Ponchak.
Welcome.
You said it right.
Of course I did. I say every name right the first time. How's it going, man?
Good. Yeah. It's good to be here. Yeah, it's always fun. St. Pete's very different than when I grew up. I grew up about 45 minutes from here in Sarasota, Florida.
Oh!
I am also from Sarasota, Florida.
Born in Sarasota.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I wasn't born and raised Sarasota. We moved there when I was three.
So, I mean, basically.
So, yeah. Most of my upbringing was there. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Where did you go to high school?
I went to a little private school called Sarasota Christian School. It was like my dad became the history teacher there, and that managed to somehow get my sister in and I in. And yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay. Yeah, we probably, I believe we're probably around the same age group. So
yeah.
I did the Booker High School and then Ringling.
Yeah, I had some of my best friends were at Booker during several years. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, awesome. it was quite a different place back then.
I'm also a graduate of Ringling.
Oh,
College of Art and Design.
Oh,
yeah, I was
99.
Let's see, 2000. I had a weird college story. So I have the classic 6-year BFA, where I did 2 years at University of Florida, and no offense to anybody that went through their design program, but it was not for me. It was a part of the College of Fine Arts at the time, and I didn't have a great experience. 2 years in, I decided, you know what, I really just want to be at Ringling. Yeah. And so I applied, and I got accepted into the GIC program, the Graphic and Interactive Communications program.
Yeah.
But they were so selective that they were basically, we'll transfer your 2 years at a state university, but it's going to all essentially fill all your electives for your career program. Yeah, so I started over. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it was 2003, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, a great school.
Yeah, great school.
Mm-hmm.
Very small.
Yeah.
Which my high school experience was crazy small. So.
Oh, okay. Well, that's probably like a good transition. Yeah. It was probably a bit of a bigger experience.
From University of Florida to Ringling was like, this is like a neat little community.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
It was really, really intense.
Yeah. I like keeping up with everybody there too.
Yeah.
Good friends, good people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you doing now?
So I lead a design and strategy UX team at a company called Lullabot.
I love Lullabot. I really do.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we work, so our design strategy team works really closely with a larger front-end, back-end development team. Lullabot started a little more than a decade ago as a Drupal consultancy. Our founders were helping do some of the very first really large projects on the internet in Drupal. Yeah. So their first big one was they did MTV UK. UK moved to Drupal.
Just a little company.
Yeah, our founders helped that, and that kind of got the company started. But when I came to the company 7 years ago, was when they decided to move from just doing mentoring and training and that kind of consulting work where they were like telling other teams how to do this to let's actually design and build sites for people as well. And so I helped start the design and development branch at Lullabot and slowly built out a design practice and a design team. And it's lots of fun. I work with really smart people.
That's always good. Yeah. I think I was first introduced to Lullabot from the Drupal world back in the day.
Yeah, he's obsessed with Drupal.
There are not very many designers that are obsessed with Drupal, but I feel like it's people like me who grew up, like, my play as a kid, my mom was a school teacher, and I would go and get the large sheets for bulletin boards and bring them home, like, every time she was setting up a classroom and stuff, and my play was, like, I would design giant roadway systems that were like super complicated and whatnot. And I feel like it was this like foreshadowing because the way my brain works and the kinds of projects I'm fascinated
with. You were problem solving.
Are like big, like what we work on are like big content kinds of problems. And our design team, you know, while we've got some great designers and we can do nice work, it's what we really shine at is when you've got a large system and maybe not a very big design team that's going to have to support it. And how do we make a design system that's going to work across all this?
Yeah.
How do we make it scalable, sustainable? How do we make sure that it's executed well, like all the way out? And you've got, you know, a million nodes of content and like 35 different content types, each with variety. And like, you know, how do we make this all work? And how do we make it so that the UX is, you know, great, you know, not just like, oh, we made it not a tire fire here, but it's because it's like the scale is the problem usually in a lot of the projects we work on. So,
So was that your what your talk is about at the conference? What was it, yesterday or today? When did you
I spoke yesterday afternoon. So the, you know, 2 years ago I was here and I spoke about running distributed design teams, which is what I do at Lullabot. This year, what I was speaking about was actually the ROI of design. And it's become a big question, with, especially within the Drupal ecosphere, because there's a lot of Drupal agencies now, and they're all sort of growing and expanding beyond just being Drupal development agencies. And the origin of the talk was a year ago when one of the one of these companies within our space did this survey, and agency owners and operators, their top question that they said they had for their business was, what's the ROI of an improved user experience? And you could tell that they're all like trying to figure out, like, wait a minute, how do people sell this? I'm a, you know, we've been a development company or whatever. And so it fascinated me in part because when I first started talking with people about it, I realized I didn't have this great succinct answer to what's the ROI of design? So yeah, I spent the last year or so just like with it in the back of my mind all the time, reading and finding research papers and trying to put something together to where I felt like I had a cogent answer to this.
Well, what's the, I know you've already gave the speech, but what's the short answer? Could you give us like a little teaser?
So, I want the whole speech.
Really quickly, I'll give you the 5 minutes. I came up with, I landed in two places. One was that there is sort of a way to define the kinds of value that design creates. And so I sort of honed in on 5 categories that I felt like are common themes for kind of where to look for the value that it creates. And those were brand, innovation, efficiency, satisfaction, and sustainability.
Satisfaction on whose end?
Well, in the talk I talked about satisfaction. Satisfaction can come from a lot of places, like, but there are a lot of things that are sort of innate to a good design practice and a UX process that help improve things like customer satisfaction. And we do things like usability tests, and there are things that give us measurable ways to see the impact to satisfaction. But satisfaction, there can be satisfaction problems within internal editorial teams. The design process can solve for or work to measurably change. There can be satisfaction problems within a customer base. There can be satisfaction problems even from a business standpoint, where nobody within the business actually particularly, like, I've worked on projects where the businesses say, well, this is what we're like, but here's what we want to be. And oftentimes that's sort of strangely both a brand and a satisfaction problem. They're trying to change. What is it that we and our customers feel and think when they think about us, when they hear our name or land on our site or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. And there's also the, like, are we satisfied with what we've become? And
That's a great question too.
Yeah.
So are you still in the area? Are you still in Sarasota?
No, I live in the Atlanta area.
North Atlanta.
ADO.
We have an office up there. I've heard a lot about Atlanta and how it's expanded to be, I guess, the Hollywood of the Southeast, and it's
The state of Georgia did all this strange, tax incentive stuff, which I don't know if it actually works for any state that does it, but it was very effective in getting films there. So I think most of the Marvel films were filmed in the Atlanta area.
Yeah, really?
At least large portions of them. I've got friends there who now work in the film industry and, like, mm-hmm. are grips for.
There's apparently more films and shows being done in Atlanta now than there are almost anywhere in the world.
Which is really weird. I had no idea.
And I see it all the time. I was driving home a couple weeks ago, and my wife was noting again, like, one of the weird little signs. She's like, oh, yeah, there's a film being shot right there now, right outside of our neighborhood.
Wow, yeah. That's so cool. Yeah.
Could be weird to drive and you see an explosion. You're like, oh, yeah, no, what's going on?
I literally had that, too, because they bought this old Costco, like, in an area not far from my house. They bought this old building. But it was an old, I don't remember what it was, but it was that size building, and they turned it into, it was like all of a sudden it magically looks like this beautiful Costco, and it's like, is there a Costco going in? No, they're actually shooting a movie scene, and they blew up the Costco in the movie. It was that Ben Stiller movie from a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The one with the aliens?
Yeah, yeah.
Neighborhood Watch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
I haven't seen a great movie.
The guy that plays Moss from Lighty Crowd is in that.
But I was driving by, like, later, like, and that's how I kind of put it all together.
Like,
because I drove by, and there was this, like, totally exploded Costco there, and, like, all these police cars that are all mangled, and all
that.
And I was
great.
Like, what happened? Yeah.
My neighborhood's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to Savannah last year just to visit, because Savannah's a nice place to go to.
It's beautiful.
And they had, probably three different films that were being shot while we're there. It was crazy. But so you, do you really love Atlanta?
I do, yeah. I mean, the Atlanta, so it has its charms for sure. The one thing that I would say I don't care for about Atlanta is it's immensely spread out.
Yeah.
So
and the public transportation system is kind of a joke.
Yeah. it's kind of understandable when you have that large of a regional footprint. It would take a lot of work to make a great transit system, but still it grew up too fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what happened.
Do they have plans on expanding that? Because I know it's like an X now.
Yeah, I hear about plans to expand it all the time. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. One thing I like about Atlanta is the destination in relation to like hiking and mountains and the beach, because you have Savannah and you can go to the beach there, and then you can go north and you can go to the Tula Gorge. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Yeah.
Do you do that often?
I love it. And when growing up in Central Florida, when I first moved to Atlanta, I thought, this is amazing. We have topography, we have tall trees, and we have four seasons. None of these four seasons are that intense. I mean, people talk about hot Atlanta, but it's like the heat of summer in Atlanta. Yeah, it gets hot there, but it's like 6 or 7 weeks of the year that are
it's not 90 months.
It's like, you guys know this. Yeah. Like, man, it's like.
What brought you to Atlanta then?
I was in a band, actually.
Oh, what kind of music?
We were what would you call it? We were a rock band, but we were piano, bass, drums, horn.
That's awesome.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah.
What was the name of the band?
The name of the band at the time was Accidental Georgia. This was a number of years ago.
Sure.
And
is there anything online?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'll look it up.
That'd be funny. it was fun. At the time,
what did you play?
Well, I helped write all the songs. I was the horn player, and I occasionally, like, we would jump, put covers in here and there, and we would all switch up, and I would sometimes play bass or guitar or drums, but I'm kind of like a semi-competent musician across a number of instruments, but I am not great at any of them.
What type of horn?
Trumpet. Yeah, I was actually a fairly decent trumpet player. I played all through, like, middle school, high school.
Always wanted to learn trumpet. I looked at there's a smaller trumpet that you can get. It's called like
a cornet.
But I can't get the sound. I've tried so many times.
It's tricky, and even people who are good at it, if like me, like you don't play for years, like you can't play anymore. Yeah. Like you've got no armature, but I was the lead singer in the band as well, which is an awkward thing with the trumpet. So,
there was a band I used to really enjoy that was from Tampa a while ago. It was called Helium Balm, and the lead singer used to play trumpet.
I'm
gonna look that up.
I know that name.
Mm-hmm. We played with them a long time ago.
Yeah,
I was in New Orleans few weeks ago. And yeah, there was a lead singer of a band that played the cornet. Yeah. And it
obviously,
really awesome.
It wasn't like playing while singing, but.
Oh, I mean, that would be impressive.
Right.
You know, kind of out one side, and you're like.
Yeah. But at the time, at least, and I haven't, you know, I moved to Atlanta in 2001.
Okay.
Back then, at least, if you were a band in this coastal central Florida area, you probably needed to be either a cover band on the beach or a metal band. Or
metal
band.
Oh,
a
yeah.
Band.
That's right, because Tampa was a big heavy metal capital.
I think it still is kind of a metal mecca, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, yeah, I guess to an extent.
Yeah. I hear people in Atlanta talk that are metal fans talking about going to Tampa for...
Yeah, there are a lot of shows in Tampa that are...
Yeah. But we were none of those things. We're like, we're not going to move to Orlando and be a boy band. We're not...
boy band.
Yeah,
St. Pete is big on, I guess, folk, and there's a huge Grateful Dead following here. Uncle John's band is here, and they're the longest Grateful Dead cover band ever, Uncle John's band. And that's type of, music is that. In Atlanta, I've heard, I have some friends up there, and we actually have an office up there, and they have a lot of good shows up in Atlanta. I've seen the lineup. There was a recent one. Or it's coming up that looks like a fantastic lineup. That's a nice area up there.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm going to move up there.
you can. You're very free to do that. So to go back a little bit to your talk, what would you say?
I was just realizing I never did the second half.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
There's the five categories that are sort of ways to, like, you look for the value in these areas because the design's probably producing it and there are ways you can figure out to measure it. But the second half of the talk is sort of about all the challenges of measurement and all the cognitive biases that we have as humans.
Okay.
And also kind of at the end, I sort of came back to this question of, like, the question of how do we know the ROI of design? Or can we know that design is going to produce value? Can we know that design is basically going to give us more money back than we put in? Is a question of what it means to know things. And a lot of this stems from where we're at in a culture now. We're 200 plus years into the Enlightenment, and it feels like what I see happening in design, which is troubling to me, is that we've fallen so hard for scientific modes of knowing as a culture that we don't even realize it. And we basically have these underlying beliefs that it's the only true form of knowing, or it's the only, acceptable mode of knowing.
That's
when
interesting.
Some of the most important things in life fall outside of that mode of knowing, and that we should really be questioning that. And that also it's just sort of, we need to be able to be honest together about what we don't know. And actually, a large part of the design process is actually a large part of what's really beautiful about science, which is the scientific method, which actually goes into things and embraces mystery and says, I've got some ideas about this. Let's form a hypothesis. Let's start experimentation.
But that's the thing. The scientific theory is all about forming a hypothesis, and then you create a theory.
Right.
But the theory may not be right. And
it's a theory.
It's
the
a theory.
Theory has to live for long enough and be tested and validated before it ever becomes a scientific fact. But even once it is,
it can go
long-held scientific facts can be called into question by new evidence. And
Pluto's a planet.
The method starts afresh.
It is a planet.
It's not a planet.
But we somehow want design to be this thing. Like, nope, we can guarantee we do some design and everything's going to be better and you're going to make more money. And that's just not actually reality.
Yeah, and I would even say that it's, like, compared to science, applying that to design, design is also very emotional too, because design covers a lot of things, broad spectrum. It's not just visual, but still, it still tends to generally be something that can be emotionally influenced.
Yes.
And that needs to be considered, and it's often not.
Yeah. In my talk, I use this quote by the British Jewish rabbi and philosopher Jonathan Sacks. He says, science takes things apart to see how they work, where religion puts things together to see what they mean. Mm. And I've always thought that design lives in this really strange, and now, like, in today's day, I feel like for a lot of people it's an uncomfortable space where it's living in between science and art.
Yeah.
And there's a push, the whole data-driven design push, if you're not careful and you look at it as, well, you know, we've got hard decisions to make. It'd be neat if we could just implement these analytics tools and these different things, and it can make our hard decisions for us. It doesn't actually work that way. These numbers often don't mean what we think they mean. And also, like, they're just not going to make those hard decisions for us.
Well, I think
it's to hold things in tension.
Sometimes people just look for something to say, I don't know, go by that.
Right.
There's the numbers. There's our facts. Just use that and let's follow. Yeah. Maybe we might have something in our heart, but that's definitely telling us the right way to go.
Yeah.
People get scared, afraid.
This is why the design is iterative. You get the hypothesis, you create the theory, you start doing your design work, you design it, and then you measure it afterwards.
Right.
Like, hey, did this work? No, Frederick hates it. We need to redo it.
Yeah.
So
the talk essentially lands at, yes, there are good ways. Here's some better ways to think about how to look for value in design and how to talk to your clients or your internal stakeholders if you're not a client services context about, you know, here's why it would be worth investing. But at the same time, to be honest about the fact that we can't know this, like, you know, design gives us.
Well, how do you explain this? How do you explain that to your clients though?
Well, I want to, before you answer that, that's mine's kind of related. Do you, when you're explaining that to clients, do you also incorporate, hey, when you complete a project, guess what? We may have to come back. So based on the contract or whatever agreement you have, do you then have an arrangement where you come back and make adjustments to the design, the implementation, et cetera? So both questions.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's lots of different ways that, I don't know that I have a great answer. I'll just say that for.
A good answer would be good.
So let me take, can you reframe the two questions? Because I want to make sure I'm not getting confused by the two different.
I think the way Brian put it at the end.
Okay. So I think in terms of talking to clients, most of the time, if a client is in a place, first of all, where I get the sense that they're not even sure that it's worth spending any money on this, like that's the fundamental question.
Then
that's something that I'm usually like, I want to actually say, well, are you comfortable? In fact, I've been very direct before. Like, if you're not comfortable investing in this, like, let's not work together. Let's not move forward. Like, but let's talk about first, like, why are you not comfortable investing in this? Like, what is it that you feel like is the roadblock in the way? Like, I ask clients a lot of times in our early process, in our workshopping, I'll do interviews with all the different stakeholders individually, our design team will, and we'll ask, like, what do you sense is going to make this not successful?
Yeah.
What's the thing that is always coming to your mind that you're like, I don't think we can really solve for this? And usually when you get people talking about those things, it kind of gets to a nut of the problem.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get to that nut of the problem and you actually do say, you know what, like, this is a bigger problem in your business.
Because that will open up so many other questions.
Yeah. And being honest about that, just saying, you know, we're not going to be able to fix that. And we need to be really clear at the outset of this that having a new homepage that's got great visual hierarchy and it's way easier to find these three things is going to be a benefit to you and your business, but it's not going to fix that.
Exactly.
It's
interesting though, because this whole conversation reminds me a lot of what Rob Parr yesterday.
Oh yeah.
Did you see his talk in Discovery?
Yeah, I did.
And like blending these two concepts, I could see something really great coming out of it. And his you can watch our other video where we kind of talked to him about it. But it's the concept is there's a pre-discovery phase before you even begin. So then you basically can establish the ROI of design with the client and communicate what the value is based on real research. So do you do something similar to that, I feel?
We do something very similar to that. Where I differ from Rob is that Rob talked in his talk about how, like, you know, make sure you don't produce any visuals, no wireframes. Like, this is purely a discovery. And I couldn't disagree more with that because I feel like this actually goes back to exactly what I was talking about in my talk. Yeah. Like, I Sparkbox guys, those guys are awesome.
Yeah.
And I love them to death. Like, so, and they're fun people. If I disagree with them, I'm sure that we'd probably end up at the same page if we got to sit down and talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
But so I feel like it's tempting to think that, like, purely verbal language thing is the way that we arrive at all these, like, higher level perfect concepts of here's what the problem is. And it's like, you don't want to go down roads of, you know, making things before you understand it. But the reality is that actually a lot of times the easiest way to elicit response and conversation around something is to let people start visualizing. So we end up in our workshop.
That's fair.
Our workshopping is very active, and we actually have clients draw us like wireframe live together. We'll do design studio sessions where we talk through a problem set, and then we say, okay, you've got 15 minutes. I need you to draw, you know, come up with as many things, ideas as you can of ways that we could solve that. And these can be super rough pencil sketches, but, you know, you've got 15 minutes. At the end of it, I say, now pass your ideas to the person on your left. And that person has to look at your, look at what you did. And they, you have 5 minutes to ask each other questions, and then we're going to do one more round. And usually the ideas that, in whether it's just designers or whether it's business stakeholders in the room doing it as well, like the ideas that come out of once you see other people's ideas, like that remix, is usually really powerful. But even if,
opens the mind.
Like, I think Rob's point is that, like, if you do start wireframe, you start just making your ideas too early before you know and understand all the problems, that, you know, this is somehow a bad thing. And I'll agree, it's bad if your assumptions are, like, as soon as I understand everything, then I can go and just make the perfect thing and voila, and this is how it works. But that's not how it works.
I could see a hybrid being necessary. So you, maybe some visuals to be able to communicate and understand the problem more.
Right. And it elicits conversation. So whether it's card sorting or whether it's actual sketching or whether it's other visual kinds of exercises, it opens people's minds in other ways, like people using pencils. There was a Tom Wujek did a TED Talk. Have you guys ever seen his TED Talk? Where
Tom Wujek?
Sounds
familiar.
It's like, I don't remember what it's called. It's something about drawing how to make toast. And he goes and he does business coaching and training with like large, like Fortune 500 companies and stuff. And
how do you make toast?
He does this exercise with business leaders where he has them draw how to make toast. In the talk, he's like talking about the power of, like, you know, what happens when people try to articulate something like that through drawing. And he was talking about how he started doing it at larger companies and having groups coming in.
Yeah.
And so he was fascinated with, he started having groups do it together. And when what he found was there was all of a sudden one time, I think he says in the talk that he decided, you know what, I'm going to have you do it, but none of you can talk. You just have to draw together on the whiteboard. You have to draw out how to make toast. And what blew him away was over time, the more he did the thing where groups had to do that together without talking, that they could do much better diagrams way more quickly. And I think there's something to this that we you know, I'm a hyperverbal person. Obviously, I keep talking. I talk when I'm nervous.
I know.
Oh,
jeez.
Yeah. Works well for a podcast.
Yeah, it works. That's not why we had you on here to talk.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's really powerful. People put a pencil in people's hands. You know.
Yeah, that's amazing that if you cut out that actual verbal conversation and you have that common human understanding of what the problem is and you just go up and just draw it intuitively, you're going to come up with a solution a little bit better. That's so interesting.
And pencils you get people, before pixels.
Yeah.
And pencils before pixels, hashtag.
Yeah. But even, so these wireframes that come out of those kinds of processes often aren't like, they often don't look exactly like what the end, like they may not be the solution.
The thoughts.
But what's so powerful is, so at the end of it, and I've done it with teams too, where like two people partner, if I have a large group, and so you have to partner, or three people partner together, and then they have to present their idea to the whole. And these are like, sometimes it's like the editorial lead and the content team, and then another table I've got the sales lead, and it's a mix. And the conversations that ensue, like all the things you learn, what Rob was talking about in his talk, the people that say, well, no, we can't do that because of X. The stuff that comes out when they're looking at somebody's actual visual idea is so much more powerful than if you're just going to sit down at a table and, okay, talk to me about what you think we can and can't do or whatever. Half the stuff won't even come out until they start seeing stuff.
That's interesting, yeah, because a lot of times people are visual thinkers. That you can talk about a concept all day long, but it might just ride by their ears, where if you actually draw something, you know what? Now that I see it.
Right.
Now that I see it, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And our workshopping, so we often have, we don't call it a discovery phase, mostly because I've just found that clients are, you know, really turned off by that word.
Yeah.
It feels non-productive to them. Like, it feels like you're going to charge us so that you can learn enough so that you then you're ready and prepared enough to do the work that we need you to do.
Yeah.
And there was a project it was actually with SpaceX that I was doing a couple of years ago, and I was trying to get to a research phase that they were okay with.
Uh-huh.
And I thought we had this fantastic proposal for them, and I kept going over it with them.
And then Elon Musk came in.
I kept thinking what a lot of designers think, which is, yeah, like that you need to, well, okay, our research discovery work, we need to find a way to get smaller and smaller because clients don't want to pay for it, or it's hard to sell it or whatever. And
I
asked the stakeholder at one point when we had gone through like four rounds of revision on this proposal, like, what is it that would actually get your team excited there? Like, what is it that you're most looking forward to within the process?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they said, you know, what gets people excited here is when we can put something up on the board and say, that's what we're making. Like, when we have a picture of Mars and we know that's where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I said, well, then phase one should actually be bigger, not smaller. Phase one should be, we should stop phase one at the very point where we actually have the first visual designs for the key parts of this thing. And they were like, yeah, but that actually makes a ton of sense. We could get on board with that. And we know that by the end of this initial phase together, we're going to have a couple, like, we're going to have some wireframes that define the system and then actual visuals of, like, and it should look like this, it should work this.
Yeah,
that's perfect. And from that was like my big insight moment. From then on, that's pretty much what we do. We propose an initial phase that doesn't stop at, okay, our research is done. Here's a document that tells you how you should be approaching this.
Yeah, here's actually some information architecture.
Yeah, phase one does include usually something that does define at least things like design principles. It helps, you know, hone personas that we're going to use to talk about the designs together, and lots of, you know, it has a brief that's a part of it, but it actually stops with like actual visual things that represent, here's what we think this thing should be like.
Yeah, that's so valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I found it way easier to sell like initial phases.
Well, that's something that you could take to maybe a decision maker that might not be so much a conceptual thinker.
Right, right.
But really needs to see something. Just show me. I don't have the time. Show me what it's going to look like. Okay, yep, I like that. Go, or no, let's move that around there, and then you go.
Yeah. And even if you're not in client services, I think I've seen it hold true with internal stakeholders as well. Like, so
sure,
if you're trying to get an internal team on board with, I feel like we need to do this thing, maybe don't try to just say, well, give me enough time so I can run these interviews and do this research and whatnot. Say, give me enough time so that I can get to this thing where I'll be able to show you what this thing will be like.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually is easier to get people on board with it. Like, at the end of this initial thing that I'm asking you to let me do, I'm going to show you what we ought to have.
Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good insight. Well, we're kind of at the end now. We're at day two.
Day two, front end design conference.
Yeah, front end design conference.
10-year anniversary.
10th
year anniversary. That's what I said.
It's not 10
and
years.
And I'm holding up 10.
Oh, jeez. Okay. But yeah, there's still time to come. You can drop in. There's lots of great speakers still left. And we're going to be broadcasting live all day long, interviewing a lot of people. So check, you know, keep I'm really stumbling words here, but
keep assembling words. Yeah, thanks so much. And hey,
thanks.
Jared, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having being on, man.
See you guys.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of The Thunder Nerds. Please follow us on Twitter at ThunderNerdsHo, on Facebook at facebook.com/ThunderNerds. Go to thundernerds.io for our website and find links to our YouTube channel and Instagram from there. Please send us any ideas or comments to connect@thundernerds.io. And if you would like to support the show, go to patreon.com/ThunderNerds. @ThunderNerds, or send us an email if you'd like to sponsor the show. Lastly, please remember to go to iTunes to give us a like or review. We honestly and sincerely appreciate it.
I like romance novels. They have happy endings.
I should have known the Territor didn't mean us any harm when the Sword of Omens didn't obey me. And anyway, it was just plain stupid to assume it might be bad. Just what the fuck am I talking about?